So the basic question is, what do you understand consciousness to be? In what way does it exist, if at all?
Okay, I'm not sure I have an answer, but after all, I'm a philosopher and I've studied it for a long time, and so I know all the problems with trying to say, oh, well, this is what it is. So let me try to be somewhat objective, and then I can try to say where I think some of the issues lie. So there are basically two general views of what consciousness is, according to contemporary analytic philosophy. I mean, there's also all kinds of Eastern philosophical views, and I'm not interested in those, and I don't know anything about them. So the two standard views are called the psychological view of consciousness and the phenomenological view of consciousness. The psychological view of consciousness views consciousness as essentially a bunch of processes in the mind implemented for us in the brain, though conceivably implementable in some other device like a computer or a robot, that deals with awareness, control of activity, what else? The senses and how the senses are used to help control other kinds of things that one does, and so on. And so what one does when one studies consciousness psychologically is you develop some kind of computational slash cognitive theory of how the mind works at a kind of abstract functional level. And then you would go look for human consciousness, you would go look in the brain to see if there are collections of neurons that seem to serve these functions. And to the extent that you can find them, or to the extent that you think your theory is right, you can also build a computational model that would behave in pretty much the same way, though obviously be implemented differently. So the idea behind the psychological view of consciousness is that it's something that psychologists and neuroscientists and cognitive scientists and computer AI people can study. Nobody quite knows how it works. There are lots of theories. And people are fairly sure that it's just a question of time before they get most of the details worked out. Somebody like Daniel Dennett, who's a philosopher, thinks that the ordinary everyday view of consciousness, where this sort of a little homunculus, right, a little person inside your mind is kind of looking out through your eyes and just kind of registering everything that's going on, besides the fact that it logically makes no sense, is also kind of oversimplified because Dennett thinks that these psychological processes are very much more complicated than that simplistic this kind of movie screen metaphor would make it seem. And he gives all kinds of examples of how it's much more complicated than you think. So one of the standard examples is what's called change blindness. You can stare at a photograph that is gradually changing right in front of your eyes and not realize that it's changing, because it's changing in this really subtle way, and you're just not paying attention to what the change is. Only after you compare
The
the
start.
initial picture and the final picture and look really carefully do you see what the difference is. So there are all kinds of examples. That's just one. There are all kinds of examples that suggest that it's not just a straight awareness, that there's more complicated processes. But that's okay. We can come up with cognitive slash functional slash computational here in the sense of functional theories of what's going on, and functional in the sense of we know there's got to be some procedure that takes certain input and converts it to certain output, We can worry about the details of how it does it, but some of those details may depend on whether you're looking at a human or a chimp or a computer or whatever. The details may not matter. In the long run, what matters is the functional input-output organization. And again, once you've got a functional description of some psychological event, you can look for an implementation in the brain. You can also try to implement it in a computer, because you just got input-output behaviors, and the details may not really matter. They may matter, but they may not. All right, so that's the psychological view of consciousness. Then there's what's called the phenomenological view of consciousness. And the phenomenological view says that that psychological story can't be all there is to it. There's got to be something more. And one of the standard arguments that tries to convince people that there's something more is called the zombie argument.
Mm-hmm.
So the zombie argument says, can you imagine a creature who is an exact duplicate of you psychologically? In other words, if you put your zombie duplicate in, if I take you, move you over here, put your zombie duplicate over there, the zombie duplicate will behave in exactly the same way that you do. There's no way anybody externally could tell the difference between you or your zombie duplicate. Psychologically, consciously, you will behave exactly the same, with the following difference. If I stick a pin in you, you will feel pain. If I stick a pin in the zombie will say that he feels pain, but he won't feel anything. Okay? So the difference would be zombies have no sensation, no feelings. They behave as if they do, but they just don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
And what can make this plausible is there are clearly certain unconscious processes, psychological and neurological processes, that go on in people.
Yeah, I was reading about blindsight.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's an example. So there's not only blindsight, turns out there's blind smell, and there's all kinds of, I mean, you know, there are odors that we're just not sensitive to, but they do, in fact, affect our behavior.
Uh-huh. Okay? And blindsight is where you can not be aware of you perceiving something. Like,
well,
they would reach out and grab something even though they don't consciously get that.
That's right. So blindsight are people who are functionally blind. I mean, they cannot see, and you can perform tests and you assume they're not lying to you, right? And they really cannot see. And then you say, well, look, I'm holding a pencil. It's either vertical or horizontal. Which is it? And they'll say, well, I'm blind. I can't tell. Well, guess. And it turns out that better than chance, they will guess correctly, the people who have this. And one possible explanation is they're actually getting the visual information, but somehow they're not aware of it. So they're able to use the information kind of unconsciously, so to speak, but there's just no sensation. There's no visual sensation.
I wonder how they access that.
Well, nobody quite knows.
Yeah.
But I mean, one possibility is that the signal that clearly must be entering...
Because there are neurons in the visual system that are specifically, their own function is to determine orientation.
Right.
So, like, that one neuron is probably firing, but the fact that they can not even know that they're getting that data is pretty...
So, cool. One possible explanation for this is there's a region of the brain that's sort of aware of sensations. And there's a region of the brain that's aware of the information. And the signal is, instead of going to both places, is only going to one of those places. So you're getting the information, but you're just not sort of consciously aware of it.
So there would be something that's turning data into experience?
Yes.
That's pretty cool. Okay. See, now, I personally side with the phenomenological...
Most people
area. But the zombie thing isn't all that convincing to me. I mean, something that I actually find problematic with the psychological explanation is qualia and the knowledge argument. The fact that there, I'm not going to be able to deny that that's there. And the psychological stuff just doesn't cover it. And I guess you personally... Do you find you gravitate to one area and why, or is it still like these two just make sense?
Well, the two make sense, and I haven't fully decided which side I'm on. I mean, Daniel Dennett's argument is, look, there really are zombies. He agrees. There are zombies.
Mm-hmm.
Weird zombies. That one way of interpreting that, I'm not sure if Dennett would put it this way, but one way of interpreting that is that if there really was a zombie, David Chalmers is the guy who has popularized the notion, if there really were a zombie in Chalmers' sense of the word, then it would inevitably actually have feeling. In other words, once you get an organism that's as complicated as a human being, the qualia, the feeling, the sensations would just kind of emerge from that complexity.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's sort of logically and physically impossible for there to be zombies in Chalmers' sense. But Chalmers is willing to accept that. Chalmers isn't saying there are any zombies. He's saying it's a conceptual possibility. And if it's a conceptual possibility to separate off the psychological properties of consciousness from the qualitative feel, the phenomenological part, then that means that that qualitative feel or phenomenological part requires a separate explanation over and above anything you might say about the psychology. The knowledge argument, Mary, who mm-hmm. is
the, you know, blind,
the black and white Mary, is another example that allegedly shows that there's this separation between the feeling and the psychological part. Okay, so there are other arguments if you don't buy the zombie one. But
yeah,
it's just,
I think it's something about conceivability arguments when we're talking about consciousness. I don't know. It seems weird to use that. I mean, the only reason I can conceive of anything is because presumably I'm conscious and not a zombie.
Yeah, but the conceivability argument, I don't think has to be run in terms of what you can conceive in your mind. It could run in terms of what you could describe in language.
Logically. Yeah.
So,
okay.
So if you can give a complete description of a person's psychological properties without specifying what they are might be experiencing,
mm-hmm.
then you that's the wedge that opens the door to the difference between the phenomenological and the psychological.
Yeah.
And the fundamental problem of qualia is that the psychological theories of consciousness, which are completely functional, they just talk in terms of inputs and outputs and how these all fit together, cannot explain or account for qualia because of the possibility of things like inverted qualia.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's possible that you're, when you look at this red book, and I look at it, we both agree it's red, okay? But if the internal experience you're having is the internal experience I have when I look at something that we both agree is green, and conversely,
uh-huh.
right, how would we ever tell? There's no way to tell from the functional perspective. The functional theory just cannot account for those differences because functionally we're going to be exactly alike. And there's no experiment that according to most people, that would distinguish it. And therefore, either there's no such thing as qualia, or it cannot be explained functionally, and hence it's not a mental feature, or we've got a real problem on our hands. Okay, and Chalmers' view is it's a real problem on our hands, so let's introduce experience as or some kind of fundamental
uh-huh.
experiential part of our nature that's over and above the psychological and see if it can develop sort of psychophysical laws or phenomeno-psychological laws that will show how the two are related or correlated in some way. Other people, like Galen Strawson, who's a philosopher in Britain, have argued that at bottom everything is experiential, and the sort of non-experiential parts of nature are just experiential things that are put together in ways that don't preserve the experientiality. So it's kind of a panpsychic.
Mm-hmm.
So Chalmers has said that the hard problem of consciousness is the problem of explaining qualia, the experiential feel, and that's the part that the quote-unquote easy or psychological problem, even though that one hasn't been solved either, can't touch. There's got to be something more there. Now, I'm inclined to agree that there's something more. In other words, I'm inclined to agree with Chalmers. And mm-hmm. The first time I read Denon, I thought, oh, this is terrible. I got to read Chalmers to relax and get the truth. But then you read Chalmers, and he's just kind of weird. So I've been working on a theory that may not, I'm sure it wouldn't satisfy everybody by any means, but it's got an interesting kind of twist to it. So here's my theory. There's an analogy between the problem of qualia in the problem of consciousness and the problem of what is a number in the philosophy of mathematics. So, people wonder, what are numbers? And let's just take the natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, throw in 0 if you want. So there have been various theories about what numbers are. One theory is that there are certain kinds of sets. And then there are certain varieties of this. So one theory is, it's easier to write this out, but I'll try to say it so that it'll show up on your in the recording. So one possibility is you could say that 0 is the empty set, mm-hmm. that 1 is the singleton empty set. So in other words, it's the set consisting of 0.
Mm-hmm.
2 is the set, singleton set whose element is singleton empty set. So in other words, it's the set consisting of the number 1, and so on. So the number n in general would be the set consisting of the number n minus 1, where this is the base case. Okay? That's one theory. Another theory says, all right, we'll let 0 be the empty set. We'll let 1 be the set consisting of, let me remember how this goes. I think it starts out the same way. So it's basically the set consisting of singleton 0. 2, however, would be the set consisting of 0 and 1. 3 would be the set consisting of 0, 1, and 2. So you keep building up this way. Notice that the cardinality of this set is the number mm-hmm. intuitively. There's even a third way that where you define any number n as the set of all sets whose cardinality is n. The way I wrote it, it looks like it's circular, that you're defining n in terms of n. But the idea is, what is the number 1? It's a set of all sets that contain this mm-hmm. many elements. What's the number 3? It's the set of all sets that contain this many elements, and so on. Okay? So what we have is 3 different models or interpretations of what the numbers might be. Okay. And the crucial thing is they all satisfy Peano's axioms. Peano's axioms are a set of, depending on how you state them, about 5 axioms for the natural numbers. And they roughly say 0 is a natural number. And if you've got a natural number, then its successor is also a natural number, where the successor just means the next guy,
mm-hmm.
right? And then the extra axioms just specify some information about the successor function to make sure, for example, that what you're going to get is essentially a number line. Right, so you'll have 0, the successor of 0, the successor of the successor of 0, and so on. You want to make sure that 0 is not the successor of anything, because mm-hmm. you want this to be the natural numbers, not the negative and positive integers. So you have an axiom that says 0 is not a successor. You have an axiom that says no number has more than one successor, so that rules out kind of branching things.
Mm-hmm.
and so on. So there are, you know, a few other axioms, but this is the core of it, right? That you have a starting position and you have a way of getting the next one.
It's like a formal definition.
Of the natural numbers. Uh-huh. Well, it turns out that all three of these models satisfy that. And moreover, it's a fact of logic that given any finite set of axioms, there is an infinite number of models or interpretations of them. Uh-huh. So now the question is, we have too many numbers. And you want to know, but which of those is really the numbers, the natural numbers? And the general consensus is, there's no such thing. You can either say, look, there are just these axioms, and any sequence of objects that satisfy the axioms is a perfectly good model of mm-hmm. the natural numbers. Okay? Now, these are all inconsistent models. Let's see. Here, it would be a fact that the cardinality of 2 is 1, because it's only mm-hmm. one element. Here it's a fact that the cardinality of 2 is 2. So you can't say that both of these are right. And then you've also got the problem that you've got these sort of irrelevant properties. The fact that a number has a cardinality in this sense, because they happen to be sets, has nothing to do with the natural numbers. That's just an sort mm-hmm. of extra fact, and what's sometimes called an implementation detail. It's as if you wanted to say, well, look, Hamlet must have a red beard, because even though it doesn't say so anywhere in Shakespeare's play, when I saw Hamlet last night, the actor had a red beard. Well, that's an implementation detail. It just happens to be that actor who had the red beard. It wasn't Hamlet who had the red beard, right? Uh-huh. Hamlet is defined precisely by what's in Shakespeare's play, in exactly the same way that the natural numbers are really defined by these axioms. Okay. Now, my claim is that the problem of qualia is very similar. Corresponding to Peano's axioms or Shakespeare's play of Hamlet, we've got the psychological theory of consciousness, essentially a functional, or sometimes it's called a structural theory. It just says how any cognitive entity would have to be organized for it to have the features that we think are essential to consciousness, mm-hmm. without specifying how it's implemented in either a computer or a human or a Martian or whatever. Okay. Now, what about qualia? Well, maybe the experience that you have, the phenomenological feeling that you have or that I have, the thing that's summarized within the term qualia, corresponds to these different kinds of models. So just as you might experience that book in what I would call a green way, and I experience it in what I call a red way, mm-hmm. that may be analogous to you're using this model of the natural numbers and saying that 2 is singleton 1, and my using this model of the natural numbers and saying 2 is the doubleton set, 0, 1. If that's the case, if that analogy holds, then we might have an explanation for how in fact there could be different kinds of quality, because they would just be different implementations. Your neurons may just be arranged in a certain way, differently from the way mine are, so that functionally they work the same, mm-hmm. but they just give you this different experience.
That's really cool, especially since my qualia I know that they can change. Mm-hmm. I don't have to have the same types of experiences throughout my life. I can be affected in various ways, so I could possibly be shifting to another definition of experience. But the thing I'm still wondering about is, I have these different ways to describe numbers, and they're all still numbers because of the axioms. Okay. They are built upon that foundation. And the experiences I have impinge upon me. That there's the subjective part of the experience. So, like, the experiences can change. Like, if me and someone else took some psychedelic drug, our experiences would shift drastically. Mm-hmm. But they would still be on each of us.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess the sort of, like, observer part of it, I still don't understand.
Well, alright, I would have two responses to that. One is, I don't think there's necessarily any kind of logical difference between what you're describing and the fact that, you know, both of these models, the one where two is singleton one and the one where two is doubleton 0 1,
mm-hmm.
They're both ways of dealing with numbers. If you just kind of look at them externally, you see that both of them are the number two, and you can define rules of addition and so on and so forth. It's just that internally they're defined differently.
Yeah.
In the same way that there could be two productions of Hamlet with two different actors in the role, and yeah, there'll be some subtle differences, but basically it's the same play, and it's just that Hamlet will have a red beard in one and no beard in another. Mm-hmm. Now, the other however, reaction to what you said might have something to do with what's called self-consciousness, the feeling of sort of you being you yourself and you're having these experiences, mm-hmm. and nobody else is. And that is perhaps a different issue altogether, and I'm not sure I have anything interesting to say about that. There are various theories that try to sort of say something about that, but I haven't seen any that I find especially convincing. There's a computer scientist, Don Perlis, who has attempted to deal with the problem, but it's a very contorted explanation. If you want to read his paper, it's on that website that, you know, I pointed
to. The CSE one?
Yeah.
719.
For my course.
Yeah, because I feel I do like this, but There's a Hamlet character. There's someone who's playing Hamlet.
Right.
So there's someone who's implementing my way of experiencing. And it does kind of go back to the weird homunculus thing, which doesn't really explain anything.
Well, I'm not sure it goes back to that. I mean it's you that's experiencing it and the way you're built. I mean another kind of nice feature about my view of qualia as sort of the way that consciousness is implemented in you is it allows for these qualia to actually be physical phenomena, not some kind of mysterious kind of entity. It's just that it's a physical thing that doesn't have to be part of the psychological description of things. Let me try another way of getting to this. Another phrase that's sometimes used to talk about psychological/functional/structural theories of consciousness is to talk about what's called the cognitive economy. How all parts of your cognitive life are interconnected in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And if we take that metaphor sort of literally and think about an economy, we can raise, again, analogous kinds of questions. So you can ask, what's the value of a dollar? Well, first reaction most people have is, it's a dollar. But what does that mean? I mean, how do you decide what a dollar is worth? You decide what it's worth in terms of the overall monetary economy. Right? You measure it against other currencies, and it will fluctuate against other currencies. It will kind of change its value, and so or the other currencies will. It depends on which one you're kind of keeping constant, measuring the other one against. Right? And in some sense, the only value that any currency has is what it can buy, its purchasing power. So you would define its actual value in terms of certain objects. But then you can say, all right, well, what's the value of those objects? Well, it's still all just interrelated, mm-hmm. and there's no way of saying this is its absolute value and everything else is measured in terms of it. It's just all basically relative. There are sort of then two comments to make. One is that can lead to some problems because it turns out that even then you might not be able to make absolute measurements. Douglas Hofstadter, he's the guy who wrote Gödel, Escher, Bach. I don't know if you've heard of him, or you should read the book Gödel, Escher, Bach. Douglas Hofstadter is a cognitive scientist who has a book on translation, and which has to do with some of these issues about how do you measure the meaning of one thing against the meaning of another. He said when he was living in Poland during the communist era, he couldn't figure out how much the Polish currency was worth in terms of American currency, because although there was an official exchange rate between the zloty and the dollar, you might, and whereas a loaf of bread in the United States might cost, let's just say, a dollar, and it might cost, I'm making this number up, I have no idea what the value is, 5 zlotys in Poland. So you say, okay, a zloty is, you know, 1/5 of a dollar. But a house wouldn't match. So mm-hmm. if a house costs, say, $200,000 in the United States, it wouldn't cost a million zlotys. It might cost 10 million zlotys. Uh-huh. So there was no direct relationship between the value of the zloty, and you couldn't say how much it was worth, even in terms of something else. So that's one problem with this. But the other problem is one could say, well, wait a minute, I can tell you what the value of a dollar bill is. It's the value of the piece of paper. Maybe it's 5 cents. But that's just the value of the piece of paper, and in any case, that value is in fact a function of the value of a dollar. So it's still all kind of circular, and maybe ultimately it's all just structural. And that is another view that people have taken, to say, look, it only seems as if there's this phenomenological field. It's really all just structural / functional. It's this big interlocking thing. That's essentially Dennett's position, mm-hmm. if I understand it correctly.
Do you think that consciousness in both the simple aspects and some of the experience, if it's detectable, is that something that is explainable by classical mechanics, or is there something else, or...
Well, if you're now asking about sort of the physiological theories, the implementation of any, psychological theory in people, the explanation would presumably be in terms of neuroscience. And then whatever other sciences neuroscience has to build on, chemistry and, mm-hmm. and so on.
But, and this depends on what you take quality to be, but how can something that doesn't really exist be part of the classical world?
Well, what do you mean something that doesn't exist? What is it that you think doesn't exist?
Something like secondary qualities. They don't really exist. There's things like smells.
Well, all right. So there are two possibilities. So first of all, they may not exist outside of a cognitive entity. In other words, this book may not really have the property of being read. Right? I perceive it as being read, so the redness is in some sense either in my head or in the interaction between the light rays that bounce off the book, which mm-hmm. which light rays bounce off the book is a function of what the book is actually made of, right? And it's only the interaction between those light waves and light rays and my brain that sort of produces the sensation of red. That's not to say that sensation doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist there. It exists here.
Okay. But how do those states come out of neurons? I mean, I can
that's
see...
That's the hard
and,
problem.
Yeah.
That's exactly what the hard problem is.
I think how it's so happen? Difficult because there's a lot of explanation, just still something unexplained. Mm-hmm. Because... I can see an fMRI of a person looking at a picture,
right,
and I see the neurons firing in right. the occipital lobe, and they're going to the visual processing places, but I just don't get how they're seeing a picture.
That's right. Francis Crick, who is one of
the DNA guy?
The DNA guy. After he got his Nobel Prize for discovering DNA, he switched and started studying consciousness. And he wrote a book called The Astonishing Hypothesis. And The Astonishing Hypothesis is precisely that. All that's going on in our head are neurons firing, and yet there's this world of sensation and vision and color and imagination, you know, that we experience. And what's astonishing is how that all comes about just from neurons firing. And moreover, you know, we distinguish between smells and colors and sounds and all that. Inside our head, it's all just neurons, basically the same kind of thing. I mean, yes, there are subtle differences between different kinds of neurons, but basically they're all cells with axons and dendrites and synapses and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. How does the one produce the other? And that is...
And everything
calls it the astonishing hypothesis. Chalmers calls it the hard problem.
Same yeah, thing. A lot points to that. I mean... The evolution of the brain, mm-hmm. we are us getting progressively more complex and more conscious, the way you can affect the brain and affect consciousness, it all points right at the brain, but what exactly it's doing, I just cannot comprehend.
Right. So, I think, ultimately, the problem boils down to a sort of a classical, age-old problem. A dichotomy between sort of pattern and thing, where pattern is on the side of the psychological slash functional slash structural view of consciousness. It's just certain patterns mm-hmm. behavior of whatever. And then there's pattern is one kind of entity, and things are another kind, and the view of qualia of the experience is saying, no, there's really some thing there. So let's just think about patterns, right? Think of some kind of, I don't know, geometric pattern or pattern in some data or something. You can describe the pattern without having to describe the material that the pattern appears in. You can describe waves without having to describe the particular molecules of water that are in the wave.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, any pattern that is real is in some kind of substance. There is a thing underlying that pattern. There really are certain molecules in the wave. And the claim that there really are qualia and experiences is saying there's got to be something more to consciousness than just the pattern, the psychological theory. There's got to be the stuff that I would say it's implemented in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what some other people have argued, and now it almost gets mystical, that these are hard-headed analytic philosophers who are arguing this, maybe it's pattern all the way down. Let's just take a wave for a second. You know, a wave in the ocean,
uh-huh.
right? You can describe waves in the ocean, as I say, without having to describe the particular water molecules that make up the wave. It's just this wave. It's got its own important features as a wave, and you don't have to describe the molecules of water when you're describing the wave. But of course, we can describe the molecules of water. Right? Now, what is it we describe when we describe molecules of water? Well, at that small level, we're just describing patterns. I mean, physics is ultimately a very abstract description of ways in which certain, let's use the expression, things might interact, but it's really the interactions that are described. At the quantum mechanical level, there is no distinction whatsoever between this electron and that electron. In fact, you can't even say, mm-hmm. well, here's this electron and there's that electron. They're just these patterns of weird behavior. So maybe ultimately it's all structure all the way down. There is no substance or thing at the bottom. That begins, as I say, to get a little bit mystical. And it's hard to imagine what that might be, and I haven't come across anybody who's ever tried to carry out all the details.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about AI.
Okay.
So, let's you talk about AI.
Well, all right. So, let me tell you what I think AI is. This is a peek ahead, because we'll get to it towards the end of the semester. I think AI is basically the investigation of how much of cognition is computable. I mean, sort of the holy grail of artificial intelligence is, you know, to create a cognitive entity roughly like people, right? Maybe smarter, maybe not quite as smart, but, you know, somebody would pass the Turing test.
Mm-hmm.
But to build it computationally, you know, using a computer rather than using biological stuff. And lots of people have said, oh, can't be done. They come up with all kinds of arguments. Historically, the first one who argued against it in modern times was Hubert Dreyfus, who was a philosopher at MIT at the time. He wrote a book called What Computers Can't Do. And he discussed all the accomplishments of AI and said, yeah, but here are all the things that couldn't possibly be done by AI. And the people in AI took this as a research proposal and started doing all those things. And he said, all right, well, you did that, but you can't do this. Well, then they started doing that. He said, well, all right, you did that, but you can't do this. And it's sort of this never-ending chase. So I'm willing to say, yes, there might in fact be some aspects of cognition that are not computable. But I've never seen any good sort of transcendental argument that says it can't be computable because. Mm-hmm. So I think the only way to find out what might not be computable is to see how much of it is computable. And a lot of it certainly seems to be. I mean, there are systems that can reason, computational systems that can reason, maybe not as well or the way humans do, but certainly there are large chunks of the ability to reason that are computational. There are computational systems that have, you know, can see, that have vision.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're all blind sight, right? There's no experience there. And they may not see as well as we do, and they may not be able to recognize, you know, some amorphous object when they look at it, even though a human could. But clearly there are large chunks of vision that are computable. And so on for all of the different features of cognition. So the interesting question, it seems to me, is how much of cognition is computable? How much of it can we come up with computational theories of, computable, you know, to show that they're computable, they can be expressed as Turing machines or recursive functions. When we get enough of it, then I think we'll have a clearer idea of what's left over, if anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that, yeah, there's some stuff left over, and it's so marginal that we realize it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That the robots that we build 1,000 years from now may be so indistinguishable from humans, except by some little small test that says, yeah, this is the mark of a robot as opposed to, you know, a human, that it won't matter, that they'll be entitled to all the morality and rights and whatever of any other living entity, Martian, human, robot, or whatever. So that's what I think AI is. I think it's the study of which aspects of cognition are computable.
What type of algorithm can be made just by hardware? So in the brain, there's presumably not really anything running on neurons. It's just how the neurons are arranged.
Okay.
So is there any way to replicate, I mean, does AI now try to create those sort of networks, or does it have a regular processor with, I don't know if I'm just not
understanding. Well, the answer is both. I mean, there are at least two fundamental methodologies in contemporary AI. There is the neural network way of doing things, where you try to have models of neurons that behave more or less the way neurons behave, and you try to organize them in ways that are similar to the ways the human brain has behaved, and mm-hmm. again, try to see how far you can get with that. And then there is what's called good old-fashioned AI, or symbolic AI, which is more the model of, you know, what can be programmed on a computer in that way. Now, the distinctions are not that clear-cut, because among other things, the way neural networks are implemented is
yeah.
on a computer,
yeah.
right? So, and by the same token, it's pretty obvious that the human brain is a neural network, right? It's not a good old-fashioned symbolic mm-hmm. AI system. So, there are all kinds of problems about exactly how all of this gets put together. Obviously, given that the human brain is a neural network, those people who argue that cognition has got to be at least in part symbolic, as in good old-fashioned AI, mm-hmm. It follows from that it has to be the case that somehow neural networks can be used to implement completely symbolic processes.
Yeah.
At the same token, it's always seemed to me that there are certain aspects of human cognition that are not easily expressed symbolically, may in fact all be kind of unconscious, and so there might be a role for both symbolic kinds of activities and purely mm-hmm. neural networky kind of activities. So as an example of that, so here's my favorite example of it. I have never studied music theory. Okay, I mean, I can play piano a little bit, not wonderfully, but a little bit. So, you know, I can read music and I can play notes, but that's the extent of it. And I can identify an A on the piano, but if you ask me to play a C-sharp minor chord, I don't even know if there is such a thing, but I wouldn't be able to play it, you know, knowing that that's what it is. So I don't know any music theory. I could not, for the life of me, tell you the ways in which, say, Bach's music differs from Beethoven's. I mean, I can tell you that Bach was a Baroque composer and that Beethoven was Romantic, but I don't really know the technical details of what constitutes one or the other. On the other hand, play me two notes of Bach and I'll identify it as Bach and maybe even able to tell you what piece it is. Play me two notes of Beethoven, I can do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm really, really good, I think, humbly, he says, at identifying composers and styles of music just by listening to a few notes without having any theory that I'm applying to do that. Oh, that's got to be Bach because the first note was, you know, an A sharp minor followed mm-hmm. by this chord and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I just can't do that. I have no idea how to do that. So how am I doing this? Well, my explanation is I've got some neural network in my brain that has been trained over, you know, 40 or 50 years of listening to this kind of music, and it has settled down into some kind of steady state, and it can recognize the music. But there's no symbolic theory
yeah.
that I've gotten for this. It's unconscious, it's a neural network, and it's not a kind of conscious symbolic process.
Yeah, a combination makes sense, because you can have the sort of storage part being traditional or symbolic, mm-hmm. you said, and then the part associated with plasticity and learning would be the network. Because unless you go as far as modeling quantities of neurotransmitters, I don't know if they do stuff like that, but I don't think you'd get memory out of a neural network that easily.
Right, and because that may just be a too low, excuse me, an implementation level.
Yeah.
But something like memory has to be described at a slightly more abstract level,
mm-hmm.
which once you describe something at a slightly more abstract level than the detail of what's actually happening in an implementation, that allows for the possibility of it being re-implemented in some other way.
Right.
And presumably, whatever it is that's re-implemented is the same kind of thing, because it's just another implementation.
How much like a human do you think an artificial intelligence needs to be? Because I have,
for what,
like,
purpose? You say needs, but for what purpose?
To be as close as us to Qualia. Because I feel like I have a Ship of Theseus type problem with consciousness, where I think I can replace all my neurons with things that work like neurons, and I'd maintain my consciousness. I think I could build a human out of arranging the right types of cells, and it would be conscious, but you take out too much, and I start to wonder, like, you know, maybe it's intelligent or has those cognitive powers, but I don't know about consciousness anymore and the, like, subjective.
Yeah. Well, there are all kinds of thought experiments that have to do with that. So John Searle, philosopher, I don't know if you heard of the Chinese Room argument, he's the guy who came up with that. He was once asked, you know, what would happen if we replaced each of your neurons with silicon chips that had the same input-output behavior? Would you notice any difference? And now, the background to this is that Searle claims that a brain that was set up to be exactly like his, only entirely made of silicon chips, would not have any experience. It would not be a brain, because it wouldn't have what he calls the right causal powers. He never spells out what those are. So somebody said, well, what if we just do it one neuron at a time? What would happen when I put that last neuron into place? And Searle's response is, well, if you do that, I'll know what happens, but you won't. So there's one possibility. David Chalmers runs the same kind of argument to actually argue that there cannot be such a thing as inverted qualia. I mean, Chalmers allows for the possibility of inverted qualia to drive some of his arguments, but then he says, as a realistic matter of fact, that couldn't happen. And he runs a similar kind of let's replace neurons one by one. And he said, look, if you have an experience of red when you're looking at this, and by that I mean the same experience that I'm having, that undescribable quality of red, the word that's used is ineffable. I had to look that up. The root F, just EFF, just means being able to be expressed in words, in language.
Uh-huh.
So ineffable means it's you can't describe it. He said, let's suppose that we figured out what would have to change in your mind, in your brain, to make it, to make you experience green instead of red. Okay. And here's his proof that you couldn't possibly experience it a different way without knowing, because that's the whole point of the inverted qualia.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's no way of telling what your internal experience, for me at least, to tell what your internal experience is, and no way for you to compare yours with mine. So for all we know, we're having the same one. For all we know, we're having a different one. And Chalmers says, all right, let's, you know, let me change your brain, you know, one neuron at a time until I get to that last neuron that's going to flip you between experiencing it as green and experiencing it as red. If I flip it so that you're going to experience it suddenly as green instead of red, you'll know. But the whole point is, you couldn't possibly know. Therefore, this experiment can't possibly be performed. Therefore, there's no way of... It's just not the case that anybody experiences things differently.
Well, what if you grew up with that switch flipped? Because if I know what red is, and then it's suddenly green, there's a problem. But if I start off experiencing green...
Yeah, well, that's sort of the rejoinder, and that's the retort. But there's still no way of knowing whether that actually happens. So. It doesn't solve the hard problem.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've asked a lot of stuff. Yeah, I have really gone through everything. I mean, the only other thing I was going to ask you was, is if there's any new developments in AI that you found interesting, or just how far we've gotten.
Related to consciousness?
Yeah.
Well, this is not exactly new development, but my colleague Stuart Shapiro has been working for a long time on a knowledge representation system that he's kind of implemented in various kinds of robots. And he thinks, I think he may be on the right track, that he's got an explanation for qualia. It's very similar to my explanation. So he's got a robot that can kind of move around a room and recognize, say, a green object in the room. You can say, go to the green object. Now, this can be implemented. He can take sort of the cognitive module that allows it to understand language and understand how to use the word green and so on, and he can either plug it into a real physical robot, you know, with some kind of vision system, mm-hmm. or he can sort of plug it into a software robot that's just moves around inside a computer. Each of those two robotic bodies will identify green objects differently. One will use some kind of physical contraption, one will use some kind of software mm-hmm. model. And any one of those could have been modeled entirely differently. So in fact, the way he's got it modeled, there's a numerical vector. And if a certain number appears in a certain position in the vector because of some external signal coming from a green object, the robot identifies the object that is producing that signal as being green. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that says that the particular number appearing in that vector position has to be that particular number. Some other theory of how to represent color would have produced some other number in that mm-hmm. position. So you can imagine now two of these robots, one of which uses one model of color perception, one of which uses another model of color perception. So they have different values stored in these registers, in these computer variables, right? Both of which identify an object, a green object, right? The two robots communicating with each other and not knowing how they're internally built would never be able to tell the difference between what each of them is, if you want to use the expression, experiencing, mm-hmm. right? But we can look inside and see, well, your color green is, I'll just make it simple, the number 3, and your color green is the number 4. Those are your qualia. You've got different qualia. But you can't even say, well, I'm going to take this robot and move it over to this body, this uh-huh. robot mind, move it over to this body and have it suddenly say, oh, I'm experiencing it differently, because it wouldn't have any way of comparing. It's not keeping that qualia.
It's not four.
Right. So that may be, that's close to what I'm saying mm-hmm. qualia might be, just the implementation detail. And that really, but it doesn't matter, and really all that counts is the structural, behavioral, functional
yeah.
features of it.
Cool.
So.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay.
I really appreciate it.
Yep. You're welcome.